And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with one of the most hotly anticipated guests every year. And he has appeared every single year on Millennial. This is one of only two guests who has appeared every single year, the other being Greg Johnson. So all the way back to 2015. Jared, welcome back to Millennial.
Well, thank you very much. So this is our 10th year, is it? Well, I'm nothing if not relentlessly responsible, am I?
Yeah, 11th actually. Yeah, quite amazingly. But yeah, well, you've been going a lot longer than that, though. I think everyone is aware of that. This has been a very full year in Britain, but also very much in America with current events, and we're going to talk about that kind of thing. If you give me a moment, and I'll just get that up. But in the meantime, could you give your own summary of 2025, just in very broad terms?
Oh, got it. Well, the big event in the United States, of course, has been the election of Donald Trump, and the quite hair-raising in some cases, astonishing in some cases, eye-opening in other cases, and quite stupefying in others. The things that he's done are really the big news here. He's practically in the headlines every single day, for better or for worse. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, I have finally been able to experience it yet again. After 5 years of being banned from Europe, I went back to Europe on 3 different trips this time. I had a wonderful, wonderful time, got a much, much more vivid sense of what the movement is like overseas. So at least for me, those have been the two great things, sitting at the sidelines while Donald Trump really tries to refashion American society top from bottom, and then having really wonderful experience with European patriots who seem to be really coalescing behind the idea of remigration. And this is especially true among the young militants with whom I've spent a lot of time, and whose energy and commitment and dedication to saving Western civilization has profoundly impressed me. So those are the two things I would say about myself.
Right. Could we, just before we proceed, could you make sure that you're using the right microphone? Because your audio is very low. I wondered if it was just me, but apparently the audience are saying the same thing.
Well, this is the one that I'm connected. Let's see. Let's try this. Is that any better?
Oh, that's a lot better.
Okay. Oh, very good. Very good. Well, you know, these poor boomers just don't know what to do. That is better, is it?
Yeah, that's a lot better. Oh, much, much
good.
Better.
Very
okay,
good.
Great. Thank you. All right. So, yeah, this very interesting year, and I've got quite extensive notes from you this year about what to talk about. But let's start with Trump, because there have been all sorts of expectations. What would you say? He's 1 year into his second term. We could talk about every aspect of this, like the election in 2020, what happened there, the Biden farce of an administration. But let's just keep it with the present. What would you say in summary about his first year back in office?
Well,
I have been very, very pleasantly surprised by how energetic he has been this time around. He really piddled away his first 4 years. And in retrospect, it is a mercy that he did not spend his second 4 years consecutively after the first four. It seems to me that during the four Biden years, he was putting together a team of people who really were dedicated to his particular approach to politics, unlike the last time, which he appointed all of these Republican time servers to big important jobs, many of whom were not very loyal to him. This time, right from the start, on the very first day in office, he signed, I can't remember how many executive orders, all sorts of things that he could have done his first term, but did not do. And one of the most obvious was to try to get rid of this farce we have called birthright citizenship, according to which any low IQ Guatemalan or who knows, anybody else who staggers across the border and makes it to an American hospital who is pregnant and who produces a baby has now become the proud mother of a U.S. citizen. This is not at all what the founders and what the people who wrote the 14th Amendment had in mind, but this has been the law ever since, so certainly the 1920s. So it will be up to the Supreme Court to finally decide whether that does apply to the children of illegal aliens, for example. But this was something that he never even got around to doing in his first term, despite the fact that in his campaign he'd promised that this was the thing he would do first day in office. Well, I guess we didn't realize he was talking about his first day in office 4 years later and not his first day in office in his first term. But this is just one of many. He has essentially wiped out DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion from the federal government. And he has made sure that everybody who's involved in all of these anti-white racial programs has been kicked out. This is something he has a considerable amount of power to do. Not only has he done that, he's gotten rid of something that's been going on in the federal government for decades now. These celebrations of every conceivable grievance group, homosexuals, blacks, Hispanics. There are no more of these high holy homo days. We don't celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday in the federal government anymore. All of this is a radical, radical change. And at the same time, as probably all of your listeners know, from the horrible Biden era, in which Kamala Harris was in charge of making sure that people would not get across the border, in which, we don't really know how many, maybe 12, 14, 20 million illegals just waltzed across the border, waved in by Joe Biden, come one, come all, America's up for grabs. Now we have practically no one crossing the border. Not only is practically no one crossing the border, Donald Trump has been very successful in persuading people who are here illegally to go back home. For the first time in approximately 50 years, aside from a tiny dip during COVID, the number of foreign-born people living in the United States has gone down rather than up. This is really a remarkable achievement. And of course, part of it, as I say, is they're not coming in. And at the same time, he is trying to get rid of as many illegal immigrants as possible. I'm sure you've seen the news. All of the liberals are quite horrified that he's rounding up anyone who's here illegally. And they say, oh, but this person wasn't a hatchet murderer. Oh, this person wasn't a rapist. They don't seem to realize that these people are here illegally. They have no right to be here. And Donald Trump ran with a campaign promise of having the largest deportation program in American history. And he's doing his best to make that happen. So this is a wonderful and remarkable thing. He has actually really gone into some of the real intricacies of the way the federal government works. There was an office within the federal government that I was unaware of called the Office of Federal Contract Compliance. And its job, it was set up by Congress, and its job was to make sure that everyone who is doing business with the federal government in the private sector carries out all of these DEI mandates that Joe Biden wanted everybody to be up to. Well, it was set up by Congress, so Donald Trump couldn't eliminate it entirely, but what he did was fire everybody, so it now has basically a director and a janitor, and it does nothing. But this was one of these busybody organizations making sure, bullying everybody doing business with the federal government to make sure that they had the proper quota of one-legged African lesbians on the staff, doing all the things that Joe Biden wants everybody in America to be doing. Now, that is what's on the good side of the ledger. Now, of course, I don't know if you want to keep, to me, the subject of Donald Trump is endlessly fascinating. So I will jabber on about Donald Trump until you start waving your hands and saying, cut, cut, cut. But
let me just interject with this, because yes. I think it's interesting to survey, you know, this thing called wokery, woke. Yes. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
All too.
You can survey it peaking and then declining. Now, I don't think it's gone away completely, and I don't know if it actually will go away completely. I don't think so. I think it's too ingrained. The people who want it are too much in position that you can't. Anyway, but you can see it peaking. The Biden administration. I mean, some of the ridiculous imagery that came out of that, the intern at the White House who was a young transgender guy, transvestite, and then that awful dance, Christmas dance through the White House that was arranged, that awful video. And more broadly, leaving aside the actual government, there was that Jaguar advert about, I think it was about a year ago now, which completely bombed and backfired. I think they lost a huge amount of money and immediately fired their new PR company who had recommended this, because that PR company hadn't realized the time for this is over. It's done. No one wants it and all the rest of it. Now, this is quite superficial stuff, but it's just interesting to witness it, that Jaguar advert was really the last gasp for this kind of thing.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. Go on. Oh, wherever you look in advertising, not just in the United States, but shockingly all around Europe, you have these mixed race couples, these happy, happy blonde women with their obviously happy Negro husbands and their mulatto children all dressed in matching pajamas, and they're trying to sell us matching pajamas. Or whatever it is, this parade of mixed-race couples in advertising does not stop. And I
absolutely not.
Yes, yes. There are many, many respects in which this wokery just goes on and on and on. I'm entirely in agreement with you. 4 years of Donald Trump is not going to be enough to exterminate it. He can get it out of the obvious forward-looking manifestations of the federal government. As I say, these various celebrations of all of the things that are doing us down, all the things that are destroying America, which have been obligatory for decades now. He has managed to get rid of that. But the mentality that wanted to put them on, that he can't get rid of. It has pulled in its horns a little bit, but as soon as there's another Democrat back in the White House, I think all of this will come roaring back. It'll become roaring back with a particular vengeance, because I believe that there are many, many people in the United States who are still convinced that Donald Trump is a fascist, whatever they think that means. And they will use every means, fair, foul, crooked, to make sure that this never, ever happens again. So I, first of all, did not think that Donald Trump would win. And once he was in the White House, he has done really a lot of remarkable and wonderful things, as well as many erratic and surprising things. So how long this can last, I don't know. I think if we have the most miraculous possibility that I can imagine, and that would be two back-to-back terms of J.D. Vance after that, that will be the end of the miracle. Demographic change alone will put Democrats back in power. And at that point, I just don't see Republicans ever getting the White House back or ever having any kind of national majority. So in retrospect, this may feel like a brief halcyon golden age. That's my semi-pessimistic view. But for now, we are enjoying the fact that, for example, the banks have been told that they must not refuse to do business with people simply because they disagree with their politics. And so for the first time in 5 years, my organization, American Renaissance, can accept credit cards. Surprise, surprise. We have been trying to coax people into writing checks for it must be 6 or 7, 8 years now. And finally, people can use credit cards when they want to come to our conferences or buy our books. So in all sorts of little ways, things are better now than they have been. How long the good times will last is really something that is up for debate.
Is there any Democrat candidate who could conceivably win against J.D. Vance in 4 years from now? Because at this point, I'm speaking from the vantage point across the Atlantic. I'm not intimately familiar with this, but that's why I'm asking the question. At this point, it just seems that they're lost. They're at sea. They don't know what they're doing.
Oh, well, the person that people speak most frequently of is Gavin Newsom, who is the governor of California. That doesn't necessarily mean that he will be the candidate. 3 years is a long time, and people start pushing their names forward, another year and a half or so. We'll start seeing people who are building their some kind of momentum, they think, to get the Democratic nomination. It's not even absolutely sure that J.D. Vance will be the nominee on the Republican side. But Americans, as always, no matter how far-sighted you might hope that they would be, mostly they care about their paycheck. Mostly they care about the cost of living. And Donald Trump, especially with his tariffs, has not been thinking, I think, in any kind of consistent, useful way about reducing inflation, about making sure that the price of eggs, which is the synecdoche that all the economists love, what's the price of eggs doing? Whether it goes up and down, that seems to, all the fortunes of America seem to be tied to the price of eggs, gasoline and all these other things. People are having a tough time making ends meet. And this is supposed to be the richest country in the world, and there's all this jabber about how Donald Trump, he's got all these cuckoo ideas about grandiose things, but we need prices to come down. He seems to think it's all rather a joke. He keeps telling us this is the golden age of America. We've never had a stronger economy. Things have never been better. That's obviously and palpably not true. That's the way Donald Trump speaks. So come November of 2028. The big question will be, how is the economy doing? And this is to a large extent out of any president's hands. It's unfair, really, to expect the president of the United States to make sure that the world economy is clicking along and doing what it should be doing and that Americans are getting richer and richer every year in every way possible. It's impossible for one man to do that. But this is the kind of unfair thing we have when we have every 4 years you got to go to the polls. So at the same time, Donald Trump is a man whom it is very easy to hate. And I could pick practically any number of things about him that, were I a Democrat, I would find him not only wrong and on the opposite side of the fence politically, but really a contemptible man. For example, next year, 2026, that's going to be, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the founding of the United States. How does Donald Trump seem to want to celebrate this? Well, he wants a commemorative silver dollar with his face on both sides of the coin. Now, we don't usually mint coins with any living person on it, and I don't believe there has ever been a coin in the United States, minted in the United States, that had the same person's face on both sides. There's a certain egomaniacal quality to this that those of us who've been observing Trump for some time get used to, but this doesn't play very well with people. And this is a recent matter, of course, but this Rainer character, a director-actor who is, along with his wife, was stabbed to death by his son, it seems. Donald Trump seems to be gloating about this death thing. He's died of Trump derangement system.
That was tasteless.
Yes, very bad taste. You can go on and on and on about this, how he's decided unilaterally that the East Wing of the White House can be torn down. We're going to put in a giant ballroom there instead. Maybe we needed a giant ballroom, but for him, entirely on his own dictatorial decision, if I may slip into the terms that Democrats might use, this is a little startling. But that seemed to be the sort of thing that he's up to. And I'm not convinced that all of these people that he's trying to indict, James Comey, for example, this is all sort of inside U.S. politics that some of your overseas listeners viewers may have no interest in. But there does seem to be a certain amount of vindictiveness about the way he's brought some of these cases against his political enemies. So there are all sorts of reasons why people, entirely aside from his politics, won't be drawn to Donald Trump. Now, if J.D. Vance is the candidate, then I suspect that if he is to get a majority of the vote, or at least enough to win an electoral college, he will have to quite explicitly distance himself from some of the things that Donald Trump has done. This is a difficult thing for a vice president while he's still in office, while he still has to share the limelight with his boss, the president of the United States. And I don't know to what extent J.D. Vance will be able to do that. You may recall that one of the fatal mistakes that Kamala Harris made when she was running for president was when she was asked, well, you were in the room where all these decisions are being made, your boss, Joe Biden, what might you have done differently? And she stupidly, idiotically, moronic, says, oh, I wouldn't have done anything differently. Now, I don't think J.D. Vance is as stupid as that. But if he starts listing the things he would not have done, for example, rattle the saber and talk about annexing or invading Greenland, for example, or absorbing Canada as the 51st state, if he starts saying things, this I wouldn't have done, that I wouldn't have done, this I wouldn't have done either, he will incur the wrath of his boss, and it'll be very, very interesting to see how that plays out. But so, while we're talking about 3 years hence, who knows what will happen? But I do not predict a smooth ride into the White House for J.D. Vance.
Well, how about 12 hours hence? Because apparently it's been reported by Tucker Carlson that, and I'm sorry to bring such current affairs into this, I usually don't do that, but apparently Tucker Carlson is saying that Donald Trump is going to declare war on Venezuela tomorrow morning.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Some of the things that he does, he has decided that these narcotic smugglers are an enemy on which we can declare war. I don't want to get to the finer points of international law, but it seems to me that when people are scooting along in their speedboats, no matter what they've got in them, and you decide to kill them in international waters, then you're really on the wrong side of what the law requires. Donald Trump doesn't seem to be the least bit bothered by that. Declaring war, he, of course, this has been a rule that has been honored in the breach for years and years and years. Congress is supposed to declare war. The president does not have the power to declare war. It's very, very clear in the Constitution. The last time I believe we declared war was the Second World War. The Korean War was considered some sort of police action that was operated by the UN. I don't think we declared war on North Carolina. That's the last time, despite the fact that we have fought countless wars here and there and everywhere. But, he has decided in his wisdom and his bliss single-handedly to declare war on Venezuela. This seems preposterous to me. Now, why Tucker Carlson's got the inside track on this? Do you have any other sources for this idea?
No, I don't. I just thought I would put it to you. It's just Tucker Carlson, apparently.
Well, if any president out of the blue was going to declare war on a country that is certainly not a threat to the United States, it would be Donald Trump. Of course, Donald Trump promised that he wasn't going to get us into any of these unnecessary wars. The idea that somehow fentanyl is a weapon of mass destruction, and therefore we can take some sort of special military measures against it. This is playing with words. This is just giving you an excuse to go bomb the cartels in Mexico. Claudia Sheinbaum, the Mexican president, I think is outrightly outraged by this kind of thing. But so, again, if J.D. Vance is going to have to come along 3 years hence and try to persuade the American people to vote for him, there are going to be a lot of things about this administration that he is going to have to distance himself from. That's not something he can do now because he wants to stay in office, and I'm sure he wants to run for president. But my guess is that he is gritting his teeth about an awful lot of things that are being said and done in the White House these days. But I don't know. I have no inside track on J.D. Vance. But really, he's suddenly going to declare war. What does that mean? He's going to invade, occupy Venezuela, seize the oil? What this to me is utterly contrary to any aspect of international law. The UN Security Council is supposed to agree on anything remotely resembling something like this. And of course, Donald Trump's not going to bother with any of that. So no, this is part of his bull in a china shop behavior that makes it very, very easy to dislike him. And so, to me, the real tragedy of Donald Trump is that he has done so many wonderful things. This latest, the National Security Report that he put out, in which he warned that Europe faces civilizational erasure because of immigration. This was a wonderful statement. He has also said the United States is at a tipping point, and the only solution is reverse migration, reverse immigration. These are wonderful things. No president since Calvin Coolidge has even come close to saying, look, we have got to, in effect, make America white again. He hasn't put it in those terms, but when you're talking about a tipping point, what's he talking about? He's really talking about whites becoming a minority, and no one is fooled by this. The trouble is, with all of these other things that he has done, many of which I consider very ill-advised, often just downright ham-handed, He's going to rear up so much opposition, even within his own party, that I think it practically guarantees a fatal turn of events in the midterm elections coming up, and probably the loss of the White House in 2028. But perhaps I'm being a little harsh on a man whom many in my circle absolutely adore. There are some Republicans even talking now about nominating him for a third term. This, of course, is strictly against the Constitution. I'm sure that if you had enough Republicans saying, come on, Donald, run again, he would have no scruples about it, no scruples at all. This sort of thing is madness to me. And at the same time, I'm old-fashioned. I admire people like George Washington, James Madison, Robert E. Lee, people with a certain amount of dignity, people who were faithful to their wives, for example. There's a certain amount of decorum that seems to be goes with being president of the United States, and Donald Trump has completely thrown that out the window. So now, on the one hand, I can sound like someone who despises Donald Trump. On the other hand, when I'm listing his wonderful accomplishments, I can sound like the most fawning fanboy. So in some respects, I am both. But it seems to me I am simply talking about the consequences of this man's actions and the wonderful things he's done that he will jeopardize because of the gruesome other things that he's done.
Right, okay. That's a very interesting, comprehensive summary. Let's get to an issue that's closer to you. And by the way, I want to say I don't know if that's true about Venezuela and Tucker. I just saw it shared on Telegram right before we started the stream, and I thought, oh, wow. Maybe nothing will happen. Maybe it's fake news.
Let's hope nothing will happen. But
yeah.
But why is a carrier group there in the Caribbean? I don't think there's been an aircraft carrier group in the Caribbean for who knows how long. As a general rule, Latin America is not considered a military threat to the United States, and you don't have to have a full carrier group in order to shoot a few missiles at these speedboats. So that people have been talking about this. I've just poo-pooed the idea. I know the idea of invading Venezuela or trying to regime change. I've been laughing at the idea, but if Tucker Carlson's not laughing, I suppose I shouldn't be laughing either.
No. Well, maybe they just want to install democracy there.
We're good at that, aren't we Americans? Wherever we go, we leave democracy in our path, in our train, and we turn all of these Muslims into bikini wearing admirers of Jefferson. Yes, look at our successes all around the world. Oh yes, we'll just do it in Venezuela too.
Why not? Let's get to an issue that's more commonly associated with you, which is white America, and white people worldwide. But we'll start with America. It seems to me that there are two events this year, very close together. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to, that have changed the game to some extent, and that at any rate were very significant and made an impact. And the first is the killing of Irina Sarudzka. And the second is the killing of Charlie Kirk. So let's talk first about Irina Sarudzka. The thing is, we can't talk about her. Nobody knows anything about her. We just know that she was from Ukraine and she went to America and worked at a pizza takeaway, I think, and then got in the wrong carriage of the subway one night. But she seems... it's one of those things where it's very easy to have an emotional reaction to it, not just the racial outrage, but the sense of protectiveness that I think white men should feel towards white women, especially young white women. I think it's a natural instinct. And what I find so disturbing about that footage is how young and healthy she seems. She's almost too skinny. She seems fit and healthy, and then she's just cut down, and we don't need to dwell on the horribleness of the footage. I'm sure that most people will have seen it, if not the full version of it. But the fact is that the emotional impact of it is relevant, because I think many people did see it. Yes. and it had an effect. I think it's had an effect on white America. So why don't you take it away with this terrible news story?
There are certain aspects that did make her story especially compelling. One is that in her photographs, she was a very glamorous and beautiful young girl. And I think it's inevitable, certainly for men and for many women as well, when a beautiful young woman is wantonly murdered. This is especially horrible. Furthermore, they released the video of her murder. This black man approaching her from behind, taking a life and stabbing her. And there's this moment that's been captured many times in still images. After that stabbing, she looks up at him in absolute horror. This is a kind of frozen in time symbol of what America has become. This beautiful white girl realizing that she's been wantonly, utterly unprovoked attack by this man she has never met. He is a black man. And then if you watch that video, you will see that the tram car in which she is riding, there must be at least a dozen other blacks. And they see what's happened, and they don't come to her aid. They suddenly decide they'd just rather be in a different car. And they start strolling out. And I looked at the timing on that. It's not as though they were approaching a station. They weren't deciding to get off. They were just deciding to get out of that car after having seen what happened. Now, it is true that later on, a black man did approach her, among others, and tried to help her. But all of those black people deciding, well, they've suddenly got better things to do than see what happened to this poor young white woman. This was as chilling as anything. Another aspect of this that did not get the kind of attention it required is that this fellow whose name, I can't remember the name of the medal, the fellow who did the stabbing, but he was a regular known criminal. He had been turned loose despite an order to appear in court, and they had not come looking for him for months. He had 24 hours to come back and report to court. He hadn't come back. They didn't go looking for him, and he should not have been allowed out at all. He was a frequent, violent criminal who had no business being on the street. The person who told him, oh, just come back whenever you feel like it, in effect, was a black magistrate. A black woman magistrate. She had been appointed by yet another black woman. And her nomination to be judge had been confirmed by the highest judge in that North Carolina judiciary system, who was yet another black woman. So this was a trio of black women who, I'm sure, judging from their profiles, judging from their past statements about the systemic racism of American society, I'm sure every one of those three was motivated by the idea, here is yet another poor black man who has been railroaded by American society. We're just not going to put him in jail despite his violence. This is something that should have been blown up sky high. I had to look very carefully into these people's background, even to find out that what this train of events was. A nomination by a black woman, approval by a black woman, and then a black woman judge who decides that we're going to turn this guy, who is clearly dangerous, loose, and not even go looking for him, despite the fact that he was supposed to come back. I think it was in 48 hours, supposed to come back and be sentenced to whatever it was. They didn't even have an address for this guy. He doesn't have a fixed abode. He's what we call homeless. That's the important promotion that all of our bums and winos and drifters got. They're suddenly now homeless, and you can't call them bums anymore. And they think that they're going to... There's no particularly good way even to find this guy, much less... Anyway, so this was a cascading effect of people almost conspiring to make sure that something like this was going to happen. So in all of these respects, yes, it was a shocking event. But as I said at the time, I made a video about her killing in which I pointed out in that very same week, there had been at least three or four other cases of young white women murdered by black men. They were not as young and as beautiful as Irina Zaruska. The murders were not on video, but they really are just as tragic, just as catastrophic, just as symbolic of what's happened to the United States as the murder of Irina Zaruska. And more white people are becoming aware of this. This, to me, though, is only a part of the increasing awareness that especially young people have about the direction in which the United States is heading. And this is a kind of awareness, a increased realization of the crisis we face that I find in common, not just with young Americans, but with young Europeans. This is really a growing sense that if this generation does nothing, we really will be a dispossessed and despised minority in the nation that our ancestors built. So every step in that direction, I think, is a wonderful and good thing. It is a terrible fact of American life that it takes the brutal, horrible murders of people like Irina Zaruska for people to arrive at a consciousness of what should be obvious, even without murders of that kind. But at least there is some progress being made in the number of people who recognize what is at stake.
Yeah, absolutely. I looked it up. His name is De Carlos Brown Jr. Had been arrested in that Mecklenburg 14 times, and he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Yes. Nice guy. And no address. You turn him loose and you don't even have an address to go looking for him at.
Yeah.
What's his tent? Corner of 3rd and Pine? This is insane. As I say, not nearly enough has been made of the judicial decisions that went in to turning this guy loose. Now, we have cases of murderers, and it turns out they have had 40 arrests, maybe 50 arrests, 15 felony convictions. In the United States, for a while, I think it was the 1990s, crime was such a problem that a number of states passed three strikes and you're out laws. I'm not sure if you were aware of that. The idea was, if you've been convicted of three felonies, then you went to jail for life, even if it wasn't a capital crime for which you could be ordinarily either given the death penalty or get a life sentence. The idea was, get these people out of our hair, off the streets, out of our lives. Well, that went on for a while, but it turned out the jails were filling up. And then all the we have these busybody judges who say, oh, no, the jails are too crowded. They're not being treated in the style to which they've become accustomed. You have to let some of these people out. So this three strikes and you're out business faded away. Now, this may sound brutal, but somebody like DeCarlos Brown, or these people who've been convicted of half a dozen felonies, it seems to me three strikes and you're out could very well be three strikes and the death penalty. I'm sorry if that sounds harsh. I know in Europe people are very much opposed to death penalty. Some of these people cannot be rehabilitated.
No, we're not. Most of the British public are still in favor of it even now.
Good, good. We need to eliminate these people. I wouldn't go so far as to say that they should be hanged in public, although a kind of public snuffing out of the life of the of vermin of this kind might edify some of the vermin, other vermin, and people who might be tempted to do the same sort of thing. But these people need to be killed. I'm not talking, obviously, about just black people. Anyone who commits crimes of this kind just simply should be snuffed out. We don't want to have them on our hands as they get old in jail and they need kidney transplants and they need treatments for Alzheimer's disease. All of this is a burden that society need not bear. I'm sorry. Just kill them. The world would be much, much better without them. I'm also not one who thinks that, oh, little Junior was only 12 years old when he raped a girl and murdered her. So we have to treat him with kid gloves. It seems to me if people are behaving that way at these young ages, chances are, and I've never looked into any scientific studies about this, my guess is every single one of those juvenile offenders who offend in these shocking ways, every one of them goes on to commit a life of crime. I'd snuff them out at the first opportunity also. But in any case, this idea of deciding that crime is really society's fault. It's not the fault of the individual. Thank goodness we have gone beyond what was popular in the mass insanity that took place after George Floyd went to his reward, the BLM movement, and the riots of the 2020 that continued on into the next year, the idea of we're going to defund the police. The mere presence of the police makes black people commit crime. The reasoning or the lack of reasoning was as simple as that. This insanity seems to have waned. But it's this kind of thinking that it's the fault of the police, it's the fault of society if these degenerates commit these horrible crimes. That kind of thinking still persists in the United States, and I don't know what it takes to snuff it out.
Well, you can't say that DeCarlos Brown Jr. has schizophrenia because of systemic racism. That's ridiculous. I mean,
I'm sure they'd say that, or maybe he's seen too many policemen walk by. That gave him schizophrenia.
Well, that's just preposterous. But I take the point that, of course, they would try to argue that as much as possible is the fault of white people ultimately.
Yes.
But there was one other story that I should have tackled first, and I'm sorry because it's funny, you know. Things happen and they're huge, and then a few months later, everyone's forgotten about them.
That's right.
And there was another thing earlier this year, and that was the Shiloh Hendricks
yes.
Incident. And it's since been sort of replicated with a Cinnabon I don't know how to pronounce it, worker called Crystal Wilsey.
Yes.
But the Shiloh Hendricks story was really about protecting our child, and it generated a lot of meme magic, you might say. But what is your perspective on that story and the incident? And of course, there was a Give, Send, Go was set up for her, and she made a lot of money. People, it was a play on make her famous. That's what the left used to say. So the right took the initiative and said, okay, let's make her rich. Let's make her famous. And yes. And so effectively she was rewarded for, what would you say, contravening social convention, let's say. So what's your perspective on this story?
Well, we would like to think that the people who are standing up for white rights are always well-spoken, well-behaved, well-groomed, accredited to their race. That's not always the case. And in the case of Shiloh Hendricks, my understanding of the episode was that she had taken her child to a playground and she had a bag of her own. And a young Somali child was rummaging through her bag and stole something from it. She was trying to get it back. And, oh, poor Shiloh Hendricks, she uttered this abominable word that begins with N and rhymes with trigger, one which you and I would probably be struck dead with thunderbolts if either of us were to utter out loud in public on the air like this. And what happened is that there was some other Somali man who was taking a video of her. And she then said, well, yes, I called him that, and you're one too, or something to that effect. And then she gave him the one-finger salute that Americans have popularized for all around the world. And this guy was gloatingly saying, okay, your life's over, and he puts it up on the internet. And yes, I believe she did get fired from her job, and she got all sorts of threats. But the fact that here was a white woman taking a stand and not backing down when someone says, okay, you've said the bad word, your life is over. She was defiantly saying, I used that word because that little rat deserved it, and so do you, in effect. This kind of fighting back has been so rare. I believe that is what inspired the support for her. And so I'm not against this outpouring of support. Again, we would like our champions to be pure as the driven snow. But most of us do not live in environments of the kind in which Shiloh Hendricks lives in. She probably can't take her child to a playground that does not have young black children running around misbehaving. Now, a great deal was made of the fact that the black child who was rummaging through her bag is supposed to have been autistic. Well, interestingly enough, only a few months later it came out that many Somali children are claiming to be autistic because that means Medicare can pay for all sorts of treatments they don't need, they don't get, and so they get a kickback from the agency that arranges these treatments that are never given out. The Somalis have become past masters at chiseling their way through millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars that are supposed to be set aside for the people of Minnesota so that they enjoy the largesse of white socialist-oriented society. In any case, that was the Shiloh Hendricks story. And again, I would wish that she had stood up for herself, perhaps in a less vulgar way, but she did stand up for herself, and so she has my support. The Cinnabon case is slightly different. I've seen only a video in which she seems to be once again using this forbidden word and the forbidden one-fingered salute in the face of Somalis who are videoing her, and they, of course, are determined to ruin her life. But I understand that that's not all there was to the story, that this Somali couple had come by the Cinnabon shop. That's a kind of a bakery and where you get fresh buns and that sort of thing. Had come by the Cinnabon shop and harassed her before. And I'm not quite sure what the real story on that is. If this Somali couple had asked her to do something entirely reasonable and she'd flown into a fury like that, then I think what she did was indefensible. But I have heard others who claim that these Somalis had come after her and insulted her because she was not wearing a hair covering. Here she's this nice-looking blonde white girl, and I don't know if that's true or not. So I'm not in a position to say one way or another, except that if all that happened was a reasonable request was met with this kind of vituperation, then I would not at all support Cinnabon Nancy. What's her first name? I've forgotten now.
Crystal Wilsey, apparently. Yeah.
Yes, Cinnabon Crystal. So I don't know the details on that one. But again, there has been a give, send, go for her, and I think she's gotten $140,000. It may be that white people are so sick of seeing their fellow whites lying down and being walked over, that anyone who stands up and is unafraid to shout back at black people is going to be a hero, even if she or he is in the wrong. I think we're practically at that state now in the United States.
Indeed, and that's given rise to a term which, again, I won't use on air, but it's N-fatigue, yes. Which has been said all over the place this year on American Twitter. But all of this, I should have organized this better. It didn't occur to me to do this. All of this is front-loaded by another event which occurred a month before the Shiloh Hendricks incident, and that was the killing of Austin Metcalf. That was at the start of April. And this is what I mean. You know, you forget things so quickly because so much happens in a year. And I think that's what prompted the Shiloh, definitely the support for Shiloh Hendricks, because people were just so disgusted. What happened there was this guy, apparently this young athlete, very promising. He asked a black guy to leave the tent or something. Either way, it was a trivial disagreement, and the black guy responded by killing him, stabbing him in the heart, I believe. But the shocking thing was, well, the surprising thing was not that incident, but then the massive support from Black America for the killer. And I think that is, and then the ridiculous behavior from Austin Metcalf's father, which was, I mean, when you talk about boomers being cucked, castrated, you know, this is the epitome of it. And it was pathetic, absolutely pathetic. And I think he actually then later sort of learned his lesson and realized, oh, they're never going to be my friend. I'm never going to be absolved of my white guilt. These people are always going to hate me. So I can't remember how it played out now. But the point is that I think it... Well, you go.
Well, that has dropped out of the news because they're preparing for the trial. This will be back in the news when it does go to trial. Now, it may be the case that he pleads guilty, and we have what in the United States is called a plea deal. If, instead of going to trial and risking a very sharp sentence after a guilty verdict by a jury, you save the court the trouble of having to go through all the bother of a jury trial by pleading guilty to a lesser charge for a lesser sentence. That might happen in this case, but it's had so much publicity leading up to it that my guess is it will go to trial, and then we'll see everything play out. That's one good thing about American justice. If something does go to trial, then people on both sides really try very hard to figure out what happened, and the truth comes out in a way that is pretty detailed, and nothing is held back most of the time. So we will see. But as you say, the way that blacks reacted to the episode. Now, as I understand what led up to the stabbing, is that this was during a track meet. And when you have teams of track athletes, they have their own little tent where they stay, where they rest between their events, they can leave their gear. And it's understood that that's the tent for their team. This black guy was not one of the competing athlete at all. I believe he was the brother of a different athlete from a different school, but he did not belong in the tent. Everyone in that situation understood that. He sits down, and this white guy comes out and says, well, you'd better leave. And then he says, well, you're going to make me or something like that. And so the white guy is about to escort him out of the tent. And this guy had brought a knife along in his bag. He reaches into his bag. What's he got a knife with anyway? Why is he doing this provocative thing, sitting down in a tent full of white people that he knows very well he doesn't belong? And he's got a nice knife in his pocket. He stabs him and runs off. Now, the blacks have all been saying, oh, he was attacked by this white guy. This was self-defense. Of course, if it was self-defense, he wouldn't have run away. He would have waited there for the police and said, yes, this guy was about to kill me and I had no choice but to stab him. All of this stuff will come out in trial, and it'll be very, very interesting. But the point, as you say, all the blacks lined up behind this guy who, from all appearances, seems to have been, if not a wanton killer or a deliberate killer, one who decided to kill for absolutely unjustified reasons and is guilty as can be. So we shall see what happens. But this kind of thing has been happening in America for decades now. None of these episodes is new. What is new is that they attract attention on social media. Were it not for social media, most people would never have heard of Shadow Hendricks or Austin Metcalf, maybe not even of Ilya Irina Zarutska. They might never have heard. If we had all waited for the New York Times, the Washington Post, or CBS to talk about this, we would never, ever know. This is the thing that has changed. Black behavior has not changed. This has been a constant ever since, I would say, the 1960s. If you look up interracial crime rates in the United States, interracial violence rates, there has been essentially no difference in the disproportionate amount of black-on-white crime as opposed to white-on-black crime. I've been writing about this for 30 years. Nothing has changed, at least in terms of the crimes themselves. The only thing that has changed is the number of people who hear about them, the number of people who are furious about them, and the number of people who say, this has got to stop. And, of course, it never stops because we don't have three strikes and you're out. We don't have the death penalty. We still have judges who let people out wandering around the streets after 40 arrests. With a system like that, what can you expect? Now, just recently, there's been yet another case of a young black and a young Hispanic. Now, it's odd when you have a multiracial crew that goes on a crime spree. These young fellows, 2 years ago, they were in Las Vegas, as I recall. They stole several cars, and they had a good time running over bicyclists. Well, they ran down one white bicyclist. He survived. But then another one, they ran him down, and he died. They ran him down deliberately, and they videoed it from inside the car. You can see them. The bicyclist is hugging the curb. He's way, way to his side of the road. There's no traffic that they have to avoid. They deliberately go right up the curve and smash into him. Then the camera turns around, and there he is lying dead on the road. And if it had not been for their utter foolishness in posting this video, the police would have decided, well, this is a hit and run. We don't know what to do about it. They probably would have gotten away with it. And when they were arrested, the driver laughed at the police. They were underage. And they said, we're juvenile. We'll be out in 30 days. This is just a hit and run. Well, it's this attitude that is engendered by the kind of criminal so-called justice system we have, in which someone with 40 felony arrests or 40 arrests can go out and commit more crimes. This is the attitude that this engenders. And only if there is a very severe clampdown, people go to jail, people get the death penalty, that's the only thing I believe that can cure this. Now, as it happens, they were tried as adults. They did have a plea deal. They were clearly guilty. And one of them got 18 to life, and another got 20 years to life. So they'll be in the big house for quite some time, and they may, depending on how they behave, they may be in for life. It's this kind of thing that is going to have to be widespread in order for these horrors to stop. But again, I cannot emphasize more the fact that the behavior of blacks is absolutely the same as it's been for many, many decades. It's only that we see it in video, we hear about it, we exchange these clips on social media, and people are hopping mad about it and prepared to make a stink. But the system has not yet changed.
But I think it is important to get back to the Austin Metcalf thing, and I really should have opened with that. My apologies, everyone.
Oh, quite all right.
It's my job to structure these streams, and I didn't do well here. I'm sorry. But anyway, it seems to me that the Austin Metcalf story is very significant, because the massive support from black people for this obvious, well, alleged killer, I think they got $500,000 or something. And then my understanding is that the family then squandered that on some mansion or something. I can't remember now, but anyway, it doesn't matter what they did with it.
A fancy new house, yes.
Yeah. But even without that, just the racial solidarity among black Americans, I think that sent a signal to white Americans that was sort of definitive. And so then when the Shiloh thing happened a month later, and then Irina Zarutska's killing 6 months after that, a few months after that, I think it's engendered something that's not going to go away in a hurry.
But have you forgotten O.J. Simpson? O.J. Simpson,
no.
clearly guilty. And there is one of the priceless photographs of our time. Now, I'm not very good with chronology, so I can't tell you what year this was. But this must have been about 20 years ago. 20 years ago, O.J. Simpson kills his girlfriend, his ex-wife and her boyfriend. Just slashes them to ribbons with a knife. And he's clearly guilty. But through a number of tricks and a number of prosecution errors, a largely black guilty black jury finds him not guilty. And there is a remarkable photograph taken of a mixed group of blacks and whites in a room. They look like they're college students. And this was taken at the moment the verdict was announced. All the blacks are hopping and jumping with joy. All the whites are looking astonished, drop-jawed amazement and chagrin at this jury verdict. This has been going on a long, 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 long time. It's just that the media always tell us, oh, this is an aberration, don't remember this. We are constantly being told, no, don't believe your eyes. This is nothing to worry about. This is an aberration. So those who have been aware of these things have been, well, if you go back and ask people, what opened your eyes to racial reality? Depending on what time period this happened, they may point to something like that, or they may point to the Rodney King riots. Oh, there we go. Well, good for you. Oh, look how happy the blacks are, and look how unhappy the whites are. They're all quite chagrined. There you go.
They look puzzled. Those two women look puzzled. It's like they can't quite believe how this verdict has been reached.
Yes.
And the blacks are just ecstatic.
Oh,
it was 1995.
1995. Well, there you go. 30 years ago. So as I say, this is something that's been going on and on. The entire career of Al Sharpton is one of blacks rallying around Tawana Brawley, for example. Now, we're going way, way back. Tawana Brawley was this black girl who stayed out too late, and she was afraid her stepfather would beat her. So she spun this elaborate set of lies about how white people had kidnapped her and raped her and smeared dog feces on her. And this is how Al Sharpton got his start, promoting this complete pack of lies, which he never denied, which he never repudiated. This has been going on forever. Black people line up behind their most preposterous people. As you know, they've built statues to George Floyd. This is black people have been behaving this way forever. It's white people who have finally changed.
Well, that's the point.
I
completely accept what you've just said, but my point is that white people this year, at least a sizable number of them in America, seem to have seen the light and realized, well, they're never going, rather like Austin Metcalf's father, well, they're never going, no matter how much I cock to them and frustrate myself, they're never going to like me or forgive me or care about me. So I might as well take my own side.
Well, I don't think he has yet taken his own side. We will see. There was yet another case. I can't remember what state this was in, but some illegal immigrant had run somebody down on a motorcycle, some young white guy. And he got some kind of slap on the wrist penalty, and this was worked out with the full understanding of the bereaved parents. And they made an explicit point that they did not want this to be politicized. The fact that this guy was an illegal immigrant, probably driving without a license, they didn't want that to be publicized. And they were very happy that he get out of jail after a year in prison or something like that. There are still plenty of white people who have this utterly insane idea that their Christian duty or perhaps their white guilt compels them to refuse to blame any black person or any non-white person for anything he's done. I could list. There's an endless list of this. What was her name? The one who went to South Africa and was going to help all of the downtrodden blacks, who was beaten to death by blacks. Oh, gosh, I can't remember her name.
Was it? I'm sure it was Beale.
Yes, Amy Beale. Amy Beale.
Amy. Yeah.
Yes, you remember better than I. And her parents went over to South Africa, and they embraced the killers, and they started a foundation to help young blacks get on the right track. The fellow, you'll remember the name perhaps, during the Rodney King riots, he was a truck driver. He was nearly beaten to death, very, very badly injured at the corner of Florence and Normandy. This is on television as well. Blacks smashing him. He's lying there unconscious. They take a fire extinguisher off his truck and throw it down on his head. The guy barely survived alive. They're dancing a little jig after they nearly kill him. And he became very famous for forgiving them. Oh, they'd gone through a lot. And so, no, he couldn't feel resentful. This has been going on since the year dot. But if there's a change, and I do think there is a change, I think social media has got a lot to do with it. Because if you do have someone, see, at the time of the Rodney King riot and this poor truck driver nearly killed by these savages dancing a jig over his nearly lifeless body, if you thought that this was absolutely outrageous and white people need to stand up for himself, to whom could you say that? There was really no way for people who were outraged to communicate with each other. Now, with all of our social media platforms, you can get a torrent of perhaps hundreds of thousands of people showing outrage about something like this, and it gets to the point where it can't be ignored. So, as Barack Obama famously once said, the internet is the greatest threat to American democracy, and I'm very glad that it is.
And a core part of that is X, the Twitter,
yes.
Elon,
yes.
Post Elon's takeover of it.
And
it's worth saying that you are back on Twitter now, aren't you?
I am back on, but not because I was invited back on or allowed back on. I made many, many attempts to go through the regular channels and contest my having been banned. I even wrote a letter to Elon Musk, a personal letter through the U.S. mail, and I sent it to the headquarters of X, and I said, I realize you're a very, very busy guy, but I really would appreciate your unbanning me insofar as I never broke the rules. Well, that got me nowhere, and so for the first time now, I am in violation of X's terms of service. So I could be banned justifiably any day now. But it's good to be back. It's good to be back. And it's interesting to me that in the 7 years or so since I was banned, certainly Twitter has moved tremendously to the right. I was something of an edgy character in those days, but now I'm practically, I don't know, a wet old hen. I'm not very exciting. I don't say things that I say things that 100 other people are saying. It's really quite pleasant.
Well, you're maybe not as much of an edge lord as some people, but you're still as based as ever.
Well, I haven't changed, but certainly X has changed. The internet has changed, and it's very, very gratifying to see how it's changed.
Yeah. And then to move forwards, we have to talk about Charlie Kirk. This killing occurred in September, and it's obviously a major thing for America this year. So what would you say about him as a person? I don't know if you had any contact with him or anything like that behind the scenes, but and his killing and the effect, the aftermath.
Charlie Kirk, no, I never had any personal contact with him. He started off, I think what he'd only been active for perhaps since about 2019, I think. And when he started off, he was very much a standard conservative ink sort of a fellow. He had nothing but fond things to say about the noble Martin Luther King. He was just trying to promote a sort of civic nationalism. You can't be discriminating against white people the way you are, but if we get rid of all of this ethnic nationalism, we can all hold hands and be Americans and overcome all of our divisions. But the longer he was in business, and I must say, the more he was chased towards a more racially oriented view by Groypers and others who would confront him about some of the inconsistencies of the positions he took, the more he came towards a racially oriented point of view. And it seemed to me that the closer he got to people like me, the greater he became. And it seemed to me that by the time he died, he was saying things that ordinary Republicans would have found quite shocking. He'd certainly turned his back on Martin Luther King. He said Martin Luther King was famous for having said only one thing that he obviously didn't believe in. And that's this idea about being wanting to be judged by the content of your character rather than by the color of your skin. He also said the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, the Civil Rights Act, which eliminated or banned racial discrimination in a whole host of areas of American life, 1964, that's considered, that must be the 11th commandment that Moses forgot to chisel into the tablets when he was up on Mount Sinai. It's considered that kind of practically holy writ. But Charlie Kirk said that should be repealed, and that started a whole train of anti-white abuses. He talked about black people roaming American cities looking for white people to attack. He even talked about Jews as having been a source of all of the intellectual poisons that are destroying America. He was taking positions that are quite radical by traditional Republican standards. And yet, after his death, as I'm sure you're aware, at that memorial ceremony held in a huge stadium with 100,000 people, Donald Trump and much of the Republican royalty was there to pay tribute to this guy who, if you parse his statements, was saying things that I suspect many of them would be very uncomfortable pronouncing in public. So, to me, it is very significant that that guy got the kind of outpouring of adoration he got. Of course, being shot is an important part of it. People pay a lot of attention to people who get shot, and they say nice things about them that they wouldn't necessarily have said if he hadn't been shot. But still, for him to have said these remarkable things about the Civil Rights Act, he talked about immigration as being a tool of the Democrats to fill the country with non-whites. He even talked about the changing demographic balance of the United States as a bad thing. All of these are positions that are very close to ones that I've taken for 35 years. And again, it seemed to me that the closer he came to these dissident positions, the more important, the more prominent, and the greater he became. So the course of his career was a very, very significant one. Donald Trump said several times that if he had kept going, I think while he was still alive, he said, boy, at the rate you're going, you could be president someday. And maybe he did have that kind of star power. I never saw him in person, but he does seem to have been a very charismatic, smart, and really quite, an open and generous spirit. There are some people in our circle who are so angry that they have a lot of hostility towards liberals, towards non-whites. He didn't seem to have any of that. He had a kind of goodwill about him that I think makes people attractive no matter what their positions are. So I think he had an enormous amount of potential. Hard to say how far he would have gone in embracing truly dissident points of view had he not been shot. But yes, this outpouring of admiration for a guy who, if you read him carefully, was a serious dissident, this is a significant turning point also in the way American politics works.
Yeah, I agree. I am of the mind that he, based on the evidence, it seems that he was very much heading in our direction in the last year of his life. And I didn't know that until he got killed. I thought that I still had this fossilized image of him from 2018 sort of time, yes, when he was a bit of a clown, frankly. Right. But it's obvious now that he wised up and he was moving further and further towards us. And I'm honestly baffled. I still don't understand now why so many in our sphere are so negative about him. And I understand that for years he was, you know, trying to, it was the Sivnat and all of, and Zionist and all that. Yeah. But latterly, it's obvious he was he was moving in the right direction. So I think you should give credit where it's due.
I agree 100%. There are too many people on our side who think that if somebody does not check every single box on their list to be a true dissident, then he is a contemptible liar and a loser and is, in effect, an enemy. I think that's a very, very mistaken view. Perhaps because I date back to a period when so few people were saying anything sensible on race, that it's generally my view that I'm grateful for the things that people are willing to say, and I don't reproach them for the things that they are unwilling to say, so long as they are tending in our direction. Of course, it is the fate of every dissident or marginalized or marginal organization that the people who have tiny differences among themselves, they are the folks for whom they really bear their claws, and these intestine fights are the ones that seem to be the most vicious. I suppose that's part of human nature. It's someone that with whom you agree 95%, with whom you fight tooth and nail over the 5%, rather than having essentially no contact at all with the people with whom you disagree 100%. But I think Charlie Kirk was, on balance, a hugely useful guy. All of those campus appearances that he made, and I don't think it's excessive humility on my part to say that he succeeded in 6 years in doing something that I had been trying to do for 35 years. And that is to get on college campuses and say some of these radical things that he was saying. He would not have gone as far as I would have, but again, he was moving in the direction of saying things that certainly on college campuses are considered absolutely outrageous, saying them in persuasive, eloquent, and in ways that were not mean-spirited or hostile. And I think it's that combination that makes people persuasive, makes people believable. And in that respect, as I say, he succeeded where I failed. I'm lucky to get 100 people if I can get on campus at all. I believe at that university he was shot down, wasn't there an audience of 3,000 people that were debating him? That's a huge achievement. It was something that of that number. And he's saying things about the Civil Rights Movement, about the Civil Rights Act. We should be free to discriminate. These are radical, radical things, certainly for college students. And I say hats off to him. No telling where he would have ended up, and I think he had an enormous amount of potential. Like you,
yeah.
I had tended to more or less ignore him. And in a way, it was only after he died and some of the leftist media started compiling all of these very sensible things that he'd said that I came to realize just how far he had come our way. I was vaguely aware of this. I remember TPUSA, Turning Point USA, people, that's his organization, of course, inviting me to come to one of his events sometime. And I asked, well, gosh, would he be upset with the organization? No. You'd be welcome. The people that attend events like that, they'd carry around on their shoulders. I never attended one. But now I believe there may be some truth to that.
I wonder if that's still the case after his death. Maybe the organization will become captured. I don't know.
Well, it's stuffed with money. And the number of chapters has increased dramatically. Where those chapters will go ideologically, intellectually, his widow, she certainly does not seem to be made of the stern stuff of which he was increasingly appearing to have been made. It's very, very difficult. I have no inside dope on this. My guess is that it will subside back into a kind of conservatism, Inc., CivNat sort of ideology. That's my guess. But we'll see.
Yeah. Well, part of the fallout from that has been, and I don't mean to be unfair to Nick Fuentes, but I do think that part of his recent rise is due to the death of Charlie Kirk. That's the last thing I want to ask you about, and then we'll get to the super chats. I don't know how long you've got, so I don't want to spend too much time.
Don't you have me scheduled for until 9 o'clock or something
gruesome? Yes. Yes, we'll see what we can do in 20 minutes. The rise of Nick Fuentes, that has really taken off in the last few months. First, there was his appearance with Tucker and then with Piers Morgan more recently.
Yeah.
What would you have to say about this?
Oh, golly. Well, there's a lot to say about Nick Fuentes. I first met Nick Fuentes in 2017. He was still a teenager. And I was at a conference organized by a group called US that isn't really active anymore. And he was coming up to the stage to speak. And I remember thinking, gosh, this guy looks young, rather unimpressive, slight fellow. But then he got up to the microphone. And without any notes at all, he treated us to a half hour of powerful oratory that threw all of us into the backs of our chairs. I thought, this guy is a force of nature, and I continue to think that of him. We had Rush Limbaugh, the famous Rush talk radio host. He used to talk about having talent on loan from God in his modest way. I think if anyone could make that claim, it's perhaps Nick Fuentes. He has an absolutely remarkable talent. He can go on for, it seems like, an hour talking about current events or his perspective on things, apparently without any notes at all, no stops, no hems and haws, no uhs or ahs. He is a very, very talented and eloquent spokesman for the points that he makes. And increasingly, he is making precisely the points that I've been making for 35 years, too, about the importance of white people standing up for themselves. I really do feel that, it's not something I feel. I think it. I believe it. The evidence points in that way indubitably that we face the possibility of medium-term extinction unless white people actually realize that we are a race, we have interests, and we are prepared to defend those interests. And now Dick Fuentes is saying those things as powerfully and as eloquently as I think anyone on the planet. And I say hats off to him for that. Now, sometimes he says things in an exaggerated or joking or, I suppose, deliberately provocative way. And there was part of, I watched a good deal of the interview with Piers Morgan, in which they have this sort of standard trick. You know, you pull out of the bag a clip of him saying something that is exaggerated or provocative or outrageous, and think, well, okay, deal with that. You know, what is this all about? And if he were a little bit more restrained in what he said on his private group chats and this, that, and the other, or this would not be such an easy trick to pull on him. And yet, that's part of his style. And he is able to laugh it off, I think, in a pretty effective way. So all in all, I think it is marvelous the things that he has brought to the fore in terms of public discussion and the idea that Charles Schumer, this Democrat senator, wants to have Congress vote some sort of vote of condemnation of him. What a stupid, idiotic thing for someone to do. This only calls attention to Nick Fuentes. And so, yes, I think he has, it has been remarkable the kind of audience he has created for wildly dissident views. Of course, his trademark now is talking about Jewish power in the United States and the extent to which American foreign policy is dictated by Jewish interests. That's a subject that I don't go into with anything like the relish and detail that he goes into. But the role of Jews in Gentile societies is a 100% legitimate subject to be talked about. And to have blown that wide open, that's all fine and good too.
For sure. I mean, it's something that I think it was always going to explode from below the surface, and I think that he has been the one to do it. And it's a fair play to him. I think it's very good. Also on the racial matter, I mean, that I think has just been boiling and seething under the surface for decades. You and I and many others have talked about it, but Nick Fuentes has succeeded in bringing it to basically a mainstream audience now, yes, via Tucker. I do think that Tucker was a necessary step to that. I don't know what Tucker Carlson's view on any of this really is, but either way, he helped Nick Fuentes to do this.
Oh, yes. Now, didn't Tucker Carlson recently say, though, that identity politics is evil, especially when whites engage in it? What the heck's that? Is he really someone who thinks that we're all going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and that America is going to be this hippy-happy mix of all races that get along and love each other and intermarry? Does he really think that? Does he really think that the United States is going to exist in some kind of recognizable form when it's this Afro-Muslim, Hispanic, Caribbean mishmash? Does he really believe that? It seems to me impossible that a guy who knows so much and has seen so much could really believe something like that. But who knows? Who knows? I don't follow him in great detail, but he and Nick Fuentes seem to be very friendly at the time of their interview. But then Nick Fuentes has said that despite that friendliness, the kinds of things he says, it makes it hard to imagine that he's truly a friend. So I don't know. But it is remarkable the platforms that Nick Fuentes has had, and I think he's handled himself for the most part very well when confronted with things that I would not want to have to defend, for example, some of his statements. Your body, my choice about women. I wouldn't say that, but his having said that, it's on video. You've got to explain it, and it is true that there is something of the comedian quality he has, so that he can dance away from those things, and he does it, I think, fairly gracefully and effectively.
I agree. I do think the Stalin thing was ridiculous. He should have just said, look, I admire him as a leader. I don't like the ideology. But for some reason, he chose to sort of ride that. And I guess it brings more notoriety.
Part of it is provocation. Now, I remember years ago talking to someone who was posting Nazi memes, and I asked him, "Well, really, is National Socialism and what Hitler stood for and all of these things are these really things that you want to apply to the United States? Do you think that swastikas and goose stepping, all of this is a way to attract white Americans?
Is it the best optics?
Yes, is this the best way to go about it?" And he says, probably not. But if you are a young man in the United States and you've been told for years that white men are horrible, pretty soon you discover what is going to really make the establishment mad. And very soon you discover it's Adolf Hitler. So if you really want to make a stink, then you start Hitlering around. So there is, I think, a kind of desire to let off as stinky a stink bomb as you possibly can. And then you go for Adolf Hitler, or you go Benito Mussolini, or Stalin while you're at it. I think that's part of it. Épater les bourgeois. Young people have a desire to do that, and it's something that we have to take into consideration. But no, I don't think it's useful to be admiring Hitler and Stalin. But it does raise eyebrows and does attract attention.
Yeah. And then finally, the Piers Morgan interview with Nick Fuentes, I thought was just hilarious. Time and again, you could see that Piers Morgan was operating from 2010.
Yes.
From 2000, and it just didn't work. It was just silly.
No, he seems to think that calling someone a racist I don't think the term racist can be rehabilitated. I think it's not very useful to say, "Well, yeah, I am a racist." The way I deal with that question is always to say, "Well, the term racist is practically an empty one. Its definition changes, it expands, it contracts, depends on who's talking, depends on who we're talking about. But whatever it means, it has some kind of moral opprobrium. Anyone who is a racist is allegedly a moral inferior, and I totally reject that because everything I think and say about race is factually, historically, and absolutely true and morally unimpeachable. So I reject that term." But some people think that, well, okay, if you have sensible views about race, and racism means having sensible views about the differences of races and the rights of whites, then they will embrace that term. I don't think that's an effective approach to that word, but people can disagree on that. The point is, Piers Morgan has no understanding whatsoever of why anyone would say the sorts of things that Nick Fuentes says. And that's what baffles him. So when you actually start probing into crime rates or the dwindling number of whites or what this means in terms of the survival of Western civilization, he's completely out to sea. I remember thinking, in the early 1990s or in the mid-2000s when Donald Trump was first beginning to run, I had a fair amount of media interest, and people would ask me questions of the sort that Piers Morgan was asking. And I felt almost sorry for these people because all they do is think in slogans, and they don't know what lies beneath these slogans. They think that they have, by repeating certain set phrases, they have come up with an absolutely irrefutable argument, but there's nothing there. And as soon as you start picking this apart and seeing what the implications are and the facts that they have of which they're completely ignorant, you can knock them down like a house of cards. I happen to know more about these things. I've thought more about them, and I'm right, and they're wrong, factually, historically, and morally. And so I'm going to win the argument. But Piers Morgan is utterly, utterly unaware of all of the depth that goes into what the subject that we're genuinely talking about. What are the implications of immigration? What are the implications of denying racial differences in IQ? What are the implications of pretending that differences in crime rate are somehow the fault of white people? All of this utter foolishness that liberals believe just on faith without really thinking about it factually. If you start getting into the facts, the implications and the origins of all of these things, they completely fall apart. And that's what happened to poor Piers Morgan.
Yeah. But there's also someone's asked a super chat about his comment about curry, that he loves curry. And basically he made the argument that's quite cliched now, that incredible range of restaurants, diversity brings this. And he underlined that he accepts diversity because he loves curry.
This is the one thing that they can think of. Here they're giving their country away. They're giving their civilization away. They're giving their women and children away to these strangers who can't assimilate, who despise us. And they say, oh, it's all worth it because I get nice curry. You just can't take people like that seriously. I mean, we're all reminded of Jacob and Esau, and you give your birthright away for a mess of pottage. That's the only thing that people can point to but that diversity brings that anyone would ever like. What I bring up is I tell them, go to Tokyo, go to Yokohama, go to Osaka. You can eat wonderful Indian food, Chinese food, Mexican food, Ethiopian food. And you know who cooks it? Japanese people. They figured out how to do it. You don't have to import millions and millions of Italians to have opera. You don't have to import millions of Indians to get a good bowl of curry. This is just so idiotic. But the futility of their arguments, the weakness of their position, is symbolized perfectly by the idea that somehow, by giving your country away to utter total strangers who hate you, that's all worthwhile because you get to eat curry.
It's pathetic and so superficial and weak and silly.
Oh, it's contemptible that anyone should say something so stupid. Well, Bill Kristol here in the United States, he will unhesitatingly, he said in the past, I don't know, he was mocked for this so often. He said, oh, he'd be willing to trade out millions of American rednecks and East Tennessee hillbillies for Indians or Somalis or whoever you are. And he wants to get rid of us white people so long as we're not New Yorkers who vote Democrat or occasionally Republican for the right reasons. No, this utter contempt that they have for their own people or for the people of their country. It's astonishing that they walk around without just hanging their heads in shame.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think when you're saying that, yeah, I would just throw away my country for the sake of whatever, a range of restaurants, you are a moron and a contemptible character.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll race through these.
Yes, super chats. No, carry on.
Yeah. Okay. Soccer City said, thanks for all your hard work, Jared. There is a theory out there that I have dubbed the Craner hypothesis. Economist Alex Craner and co. think that Wall Street is in an economic war with the City of London. Recent events seem to bear this out, such as the US National Security Strategy. Any thoughts? That's not your usual kind of question.
No, I don't think Wall Street is battling with the City of London any more than it ever has. Both New York and the City of London want to have as much of the financial markets as possible. I don't think there's anything new there. This national security strategy, on the other hand, Europeans have taken it as a kind of an attack on Europe. Is America now an enemy? Well, That strategy paper does not treat Europe as an enemy at all. It treats Europe as an ally in this marvelous adventure we call Western civilization. It says, in effect, to Europe, please don't let your civilization be erased by immigration. Please remain European. It goes on to say, if Europe becomes majority non-white, we will no longer be dealing with the nations that signed the NATO Pact in 1949. These will be different countries. It's saying, please remain European. This is not an attack on Europe. This is a love letter to Europe, to the Europe that we once knew and that we know Europe can eventually become. So there has been a complete misunderstanding about that, certainly in European capitals. And I don't quite see the connection between the national security strategy paper and any kind of economic competition between New York money center banks and the City of London. But certainly that's my view. There's no newfound opposition to Europe per se. And the strategy paper is a plea to Europe to please remain European.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Armchair Limerick nationalist, I'm not going to ask that question because I think we know the answer. It's who owns the advert agencies. Yes. Matt B., every time I see someone on Twitter claim that someone born in the UK is British, I ask, this man was born and raised in Japan. Is he Japanese? And include a photo of Jared. Nobody has yet responded.
Well, my grandmother used to put it in her good Southern terms. She says, you plant a carrot in the potato patch, and it's not going to be a potato. And anyone should understand this. Just today, we had an editorial in the New York Times written by Vivek Ramaswamy. He, of course, was a candidate for the Republican nomination for president. He's running to be governor of Ohio. And it's this blast in which he says, I detect this sense among the Groiper right of people who think that America is a blood and soil nation. No, 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 it's not. Anyone can be an American. And this is such historical baloney, utter baloney. We have a paper on the American Renaissance website that goes through all of the statements of the founding fathers. Every president of the United States, clear up to John Kennedy, was an absolute blood and soil white man. The idea that any clown from anywhere could be an American just by mouthing a few words or, I don't know, learning to speak English and drinking Coca-Cola, this is utter nonsense. And I'm like your Super Chat author. Whenever we get some Packy or a subcontinental who tells us, we can be just as American as you, I just can't stand it. I suspect there's nothing that makes me more angry than that, unless it's taking down the monuments to my Confederate ancestors. But just the absolute arrogance of it all. Now, Vivek Ramaswamy happens to be born in the United States, but that's not a requirement. You get these people from India or Pakistan, they come waltzing into the country and they start telling us how to run it. They start telling us that diversity is a great thing, that I guess we were about to choke to death on our own white homogeneity until they came along and they really made the country worthwhile. I just wish I could slap them.
Of course. Okay, and then Easy said, right, okay, I have no idea what this is about someone called HT and Phil bombarding. So I'm just going to ignore that stuff. I have no idea what it's about, and I think it's trolling. So okay. Night Nation Review says, great discussion with Mr. Taylor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Countersignal said, Mr. Taylor is right about the significance of social media in increasing white awareness of these problems. Good stream, Moz. Well, thank you very much. And Matt B. also said, let's not forget about the DOJ's community relationship service that visits people after interracial violence stories get national attention. They instruct the family members on what to say, and then they control the narrative. And we have similar things in Britain.
Well, hold on. I have looked very carefully into that community relations service, and I do not believe that it does that. Many people have accused it of doing that, but I have looked into it about as carefully as possible. The community service, interestingly enough, is under orders not to talk about what it does. But they have had a few former members who have been interviewed with these oral history projects, and they talk about going into communities and doing various things, but not once have they talked about pouncing on the family of some poor white person who has been beaten to death or raped and dismembered and saying, okay, fellas, we want you to take a particular line. I've seen no evidence that they do that. And my guess is, if they did that, probably some people they had approached in that way who were not prepared to take that line would be outraged and we would have heard of it. I don't think that's what they do. They go in and they try to argue for, by and large, the non-whites in any kind of white-non-white disagreement. They're supposed to be honest brokers. They're supposed to step in and say, well, okay, we can work the middleman and make sure we can work something out. But I've seen no evidence they do that despite all the accusations that they have.
Okay. All right, and there were two other super chats. Hold on a second, let me see. Ah, yes. This is from they're both from TIN. Merry Millennial, looking to nature for territorial behaviors that we might copy to reverse the Great Replacement. One thought is skunks. What if we genetically engineer ourselves to emit an odor that to other races is repulsive and induces vomiting, but to us is neutral or pleasant?
Well, no thanks. No thanks. We seem to emit an odor that all other races find absolutely irresistible. They come flocking to us wherever we are. I don't think we can change our nature.
Indeed. He also said Christianity, and this is about Christianity, mm-hmm. He says it's dysgenic due to its evangelism to other races, which leads to mixing, and charity attracting poor people, and the moral imperative to save those incapable of surviving on their own. Accumulated dysgenics then push everything towards leftism. So this is a well-worn issue, and I think we've even talked about it before. But yes, do you have anything to say about Christianity as a weakness?
Well, certainly people make that argument, and there are reasons to make that argument. But let us not forget that white people have been Christians for about 1,000 years. And it's only in the last, say, 75 or 80 that we have become suicidal. My view is that Christianity, yes, it contains parts that can be used to argue for universalism, and it is a universal faith. But, for example, my Confederate ancestors were more fervent Christians than practically any Christians walking around today. This by no means was a hindrance for their views of how society should be organized. The people who created the Spanish Empire, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Portuguese Empire, these were all fervent Christian believers. I think that Christianity has been perverted just the way all other institutions have. And when you look at who is doing the most deliberate and effective wrecking of white consciousness, it is not Christians. You will find a lot of Jews and a lot of Gentiles who may once have been Christians, but certainly are not. Now, there are a certain brand of liberal BLM, fly the homo flag Christians. But by and large, if you find Americans who are regular churchgoers, you will find that they tend to be much more conservative on things about race or immigration than people who are atheists, for example. Atheists are some of the most destructive operators in the United States. Those who are prepared to say that they are atheists, they are prepared to tear down practically everything about Western civilization in a way that churchgoers do not. So I'll repeat myself and say that Christianity certainly has vulnerabilities. The fact that it is a universal religion is one of them, but many are. There's nothing about Hinduism that couldn't make it a universal religion. Islam, of course, claims to be a universal religion. But Christianity in and of itself, the way it's been practiced for hundreds and hundreds of years by white people, has not been the road to suicide. And I think that it, again, has been perverted and denatured in the way so many aspects of our civilization have been perverted and denatured.
All right. And then there was one more from Ranulf. I was living in Japan when I started my racial awakening, then in South Korea. I felt more accepted as a white man there than in the US. Now I live in another white country. No more yellow fever. Well, that's a success story for Ranulf. So thank you and well done.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, I have had very pleasant times in Mexico. Mexico is a nation that does not seem to hold white people in low regard either. In a way, Mexico seems on an institutional level to appreciate white people in a way that the United States, at least recently, has not. This is something that you find all over the place. If I talk about my Confederate ancestors, there are many Americans who will just rise up in horror. But practically any country outside of the United States, you'll find that people have a certain respect. They think that the Confederate flag is a sign of standing up to tyranny. It's people who are fighting for their rights. It's kind of a heroic flag. I remember during the Solidarity demonstrations in Poland, some people were waving the battle flag. This is a sign of fighting for their rights. Hooray. Now, often it's in the United States and, in Britain as well. Sees me in Britain, in some respects, you're even more degenerate than we are in terms of people apologizing for being alive and being white and being allowed to breathe. But it's in our own countries where we face this kind of foolishness. Other countries don't feel that way at all.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's end it there. Rather abrupt, but we are over time already. Would you like to close with some reasons for optimism, since that was one of the things he suggested?
Well, excuse me. We didn't talk about something that I thought perhaps we might touch on, and that is the experiences I've had in my three trips to Europe. I've spoken or attended racially oriented conferences in Italy and in Finland, and in Great Britain, and where else? Portugal. And everywhere I've gone, I've been struck by an almost identical, a unifying sense of what is at stake, what must be done, who we are, and where we must go. It's all, these people are all part of what I call the World Brotherhood of Europeans. Wide awake young white people, they see the problems in a remarkably congruent and similar way. And at the same time, just as they do in the United States, these young white people are committed, they're determined, they are knowledgeable, and I find them extremely, extremely impressive. And sometimes when I meet some of these groups, they will tell me that I have inspired them to stand up for white people. What I always tell them is they inspire me. They give me not just hope that our race and culture will survive. They give me confidence that it will. And so I would like to pass on to your viewers the fact that I am more confident, I am more optimistic, I am more encouraged by the willingness and the determination of young whites to save their civilization than I have ever been before. And so I look forward to a year 2026 and on to 27, in which I will be even more encouraged.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope that that does happen. And I like you, I feel more confident than ever as well, because I sense this rising racial consciousness. And I think it's great. I think it's great. You've been waiting for it a lot longer than I have.
Yes, I have. Maybe that's why I am so much happier. I've been waiting a long time.
All right. Well, let's end it there. This has been another lovely appearance from Uncle Jared, as you are known in the community. Yes. So thank you very much for doing it.
If I keep on much longer, I'll be Grandpa Jared. I'll settle for Uncle for now. Anyway, thank you so much for inviting me.
All right. I'll be back in 10 minutes with the final guest for tonight. But in the meantime, Jared Taylor, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
It's always a pleasure.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.